You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, September 29th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, a couple of milestones in the COVID pandemic situation.
Different than millstones. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, the world surpassed 1 million deaths.
Yes.
That was big.
Wow.
And
deaths.
The U.S. Deaths, passed 200,000 deaths. I don't know. Was that last week? Did we do that?
It was just within the last few days, I feel like.
Yeah. Yes, we're at 204,000 now. It's about 1,000 per day. So, it's a few days ago. And very little fanfare, you know, in the U.S. about that. Nothing like the 100,000 I thought was a bigger news story than the 200.
That's COVID fatigue. No, it's sad.
Are we becoming desensitized?
Oh, yeah.
I hope not.
I think
don't
so.
Don't worry, Steve. We'll have a big thing when we hit 500.
Yeah. Oh, God. We're not getting there.
Gosh. Really?
I mean, just because the news didn't go crazy on it doesn't mean that that number isn't affecting people and really pissing people off. I think in general, Steve, we are all completely exhausted by the news and everything that we hear in the news on a daily basis. It's been way too much. And you just get to the point where, okay, the glass is full and you can't really pour anything else in there.
Yeah. You just got to do what I do now, you know, like focus on Halloween. That's it.
and eat lots of chocolate
I feel
and peanut
so
butter.
Much better now. Yeah.
So nice. Well, in all honesty, one of the things that you do when there's a long-term stressor in your life, whatever that is, you got to give yourself mental holidays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like definitely. So absolutely. But if you have a major way to distract yourself, do something fun, take a vacation, or just like tune out the news for a week, do something to completely reset your mental batteries. Don't do day in, day out consuming the same stressful situation, you know.
Plus with the pandemic, I mean, I haven't taken like any vacation this year yet. I mean, there's like no vacation to go on. I just canceled an awesome Disney trip for November, damn it. So what I'll do is in October, I'm going to take like long weekends. You know, I'm going to take like Friday and Monday off, like maybe twice. Maybe Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I mean, those are good to do.
And our boss basically told us, yeah, this is the fall and like early winter is a good time to take a vacation because we had like mandatory no vacations, you know, over the, you know, through the spring
right.
and summer.
They would not let you take the days, right?
Because we had to make up for the shutdown, right? We had a backlog that we had to get through. So we had extra days. It was extra work, no vacations. So now I was like, all right, now's the time to take your vacation because when that second wave comes, we're going to be in, the same situation again.
So like, great.
You know, we obviously don't know what's going to happen, but that's the other thing, gearing up for round two, you know, because we can't guarantee it's not going to happen at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote today about herd immunity. I wanted to chat a little bit about that.
Immunity or mentality?
I always get those two confused. They sound so similar. So, you know, the basic concept is if enough people are immune to a specific infection, then that organism, virus, bacteria, whatever, doesn't have enough susceptible hosts to spread to, and that shuts down community spread, right? So that's the idea with vaccinations. You vaccinate enough people, they have antibodies that render them resistant, and then infections can't spread, or the spread never gets beyond a very, very local local situation, doesn't become an epidemic, right? An outbreak does not become an epidemic. An epidemic does not become a pandemic. That's the idea. What's the number of people you need to have antibodies, have resistance to achieve herd immunity? It depends on the organism. It depends how contagious, how infectious it is. So, and it ranges anywhere from 50 to 90, 95%, right? Measles is highly contagious and you need something like 95% to get really effective herd immunity, whereas other things are a lot lower.
Right.
These are the questions surrounding COVID-19 and herd immunity. One is, you know, how contagious is it? What is the number we need to get to in order to have effective herd immunity? The second is, you know, will vaccines effectively achieve that? And then third is, will just the infection itself, will the pandemic itself, people becoming infected and surviving, eventually get us to herd immunity? And that's sort of the big controversial, you know, claim. And the idea that some governments may be saying, well, let's just rely on natural herd immunity, you know, and that's occasionally cropped up even in U.S. politics. Somebody saying, eh, everyone's going to get it eventually. Let's just get there and then we'll be immune. We'll have herd immunity.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So which is not the thing to do, by the way. So there's a recent study. This is what prompted all this. There's a recent study that looked at 28,000 people. It was a convenience sample. It was people who were getting their blood drawn every month because they were on dialysis. So they were able to not only get data on a lot of people, but follow them over time. And this is also was in 46 different states. So in the United States, it's a very broad sample and was demographically very representative as well, although there was a slight underrepresentation of non-Hispanic blacks. But generally speaking, it was demographically pretty good. And what they found was that averaging the entire country, about 9.7% of people have antibodies, which is about 10 times more than the number of people who had confirmed cases. So, or it's 9.3%. So the that means that even after 7 million cases and 205,000 deaths, we're at about 9.3%. on our way to herd immunity, which is going to be anywhere between 50 and 90%, right? So basically, we're nowhere near it.
That's a slow crawl.
Yeah. So if you extrapolate, that would mean we would need between 1 and 2 million deaths before we get to natural herd immunity.
Unacceptable.
Not a good goal.
Not a good path to get there. Now, there was a lot of regional differences. The Northeast was the highest at somewhere between 26, 27%. New York State itself was about 33%. But that's, yeah, so the states that were really hit hard had a higher rate. So even New York State, who was hammered in the spring, and where most of our early deaths come from New York, they're not close to herd immunity either.
And that was before we had like good social distancing measures, before people had PPE, before we were doing anything to try and prevent this, or at least in the early stages.
The outbreak happened before we really knew what was going on. So the other way to look at this is how long would it take for us to get to herd immunity? So at the current rate, it would take about 3 years. Right, so we really want this to simmer along for 3 years before we get to even the minimal level of potential herd immunity, and it may be longer. It may be 4 or 5 years.
Well, it could be less. I mean, if we just had one massive orgy, I mean, that would happen pretty fast.
So that's the other
idea.
But that's the thing. I know you're kidding, but that was my next point. The other way to do it is to have more cases quicker, but that's exactly what increases the death rate. Right.
Yeah, that's the whole point of flattening the curve is to prevent
that. We can't handle that.
It overwhelms our healthcare systems, and then you get not only a higher rate of death from COVID, you get even lots ancillary deaths because nobody can go to the hospital. So
let's call that needless death because we know how to prevent that.
Right. So that doesn't work. So like letting this thing simmer for 3 to 5 years or, shooting up the death toll by trying to make it happen faster, and in any case having like a minimum of 1 to 2 million deaths before we get to natural herd immunity. None of these things are viable or desirable.
Or ethical.
Or ethical. It's just not going to happen. And I haven't even included another variable, which is how long does immunity last? What if it lasts for 3 months? At this point, that's all we can say. It's at least 3 months, but we don't know if it's any longer than that. But let's say it's useless. Right. Let's say it's a year even. A year would be great, right? If you're getting a vaccine, you get one vaccine a year and your immunity lasts for a year. And that's kind of what they're hoping for with the vaccine. That's not even
treat
guaranteed.
It like flu in that
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But let's say it takes you 3 years to have enough cases, but immunity's running out after a year or 2 years or even 3 years. The point is, by the time you come around again, the people are losing their immunity who had it originally. And so you'll never get to herd immunity. That's the point. You'll never get there.
Oh, yeah. You
get to a steady state of people who are resistant, who have antibodies or memory cells that can resist it. And it never gets to herd immunity because by the time you infect enough new people, the original people lost their immunity.
Ugh.
So it's never going to happen. Our only hope is a vaccine.
Is a vaccine. And the question is, when it comes to immunity of specific viral diseases, and coronavirus is its own thing, we know that. generally speaking, are vaccines more effective than exposure immunity? Like, is a vaccine a better option anyway because it's going to make me less likely to catch a disease than if I got the disease once? Or does that just way too variable?
Yeah, it's a question you have to ask for each individual mm-hmm. disease. And sometimes the disease gives longer lasting immunity than vaccines, and sometimes it's the other way around.
Right.
The advantage that vaccines have are numerous, but that, like for with a vaccine, you can give adjuvants, and the adjuvants enhance the immune response.
There you
so,
go. Okay.
Right, that's what they're for, right? So you get a bigger immune response than you would get with just a natural
pump
exposure.
Up that vaccination.
What's an example of that? Are those bundled in with the vaccine?
Yeah, that's the whole point. Yeah, they're bundled in with the vaccine. The vaccine is manufactured with adjuvants that enhance the immune response.
Causes autism.
Yeah. Well, and then,
well, no, really. Couldn't you see the anti-vaxxers coming out?
They already say
that.
They already say it.
This isn't new. This is all
that's 20 years old, that claim, that it's the
adjuvants. Evan, you predicted the past.
Yeah. All right. I thought it was all, you know, thimerosal.
Nope. It's a
weird one. Yeah, that's
why
you can give a lower level of either like a heat killed or a synthetic or a live
active. Well, the thing is, if it's dead, you can give – that's the other advantage. You can give a huge bolus because it's dead. Who cares? Right, for the attenuated virus, it's different. But for a dead virus or a partial, like a protein or whatever, if it's not alive, you can give a massive stimulation because it's not going to cause an infection. Mm-hmm. And so that's another advantage as well. Sometimes the vaccine gives you longer lasting and better immunity than getting the infection itself. And that's what they're hoping here. That's what they're
hoping
here.
Right, because we know so little about this. We have to kind of, I guess, at least try and develop a vaccine that plans for that eventuality. Because we still don't know, like you said, we don't even know if we are completely immune if we get sick.
Yep.
And we don't know how long that immunity is.
And so a lot of the vaccines are two-dose vaccines. That's the other thing that you could do with a vaccine. You give one dose, you wait 6 weeks, and right at that perfect time an additive response, you give a second dose, right? So it's like getting infected twice. So that's something else you could do with vaccines that you don't do with an infection. But that would be hard because when you every time you increase a vaccine, a shot in the sequence, in the schedule to get immune to one thing, the compliance goes down, right? So there's a certain number
of
people.
From a public health perspective.
They get the first vaccine, but they don't show up to get the second one. And so the one-shot vaccines from a public health perspective are better. Yeah. And some out there are claiming that it will be a one-shot vaccine. But again, until those phase 3 trials are done and we get data and people pore over that data and we do follow-up, et cetera, and we do real-world testing where we know that they're actually resistant to getting the virus, we just don't know the answer to a lot of these questions. We just don't know. So, we're flying blind with it's not even been a year yet. It's 9 months, right? It hasn't even been a full year.
I know.
With COVID-19.
People are impatient.
Yeah.
It's moving incredibly fast. I mean, you have to say the science is just...
It really is.
...really fast. But when you think about it, like, we're at the point now with COVID-19, similar to where we are with SARS-CoV-1, which we've had for 9 years, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That goes to show you how quick the
research has been.
We did get to see, you know, what the world can do when we really want to do it.
Yeah.
And I liked that, you know, so many companies and so many institutions like really jumped on this.
Yeah.
That was encouraging, you know, but the thing that scares me is like the certain governments are willing to give people vaccines that aren't completely done being tested, like that's...
Well, and even beyond that, what scares me is how minimally participatory our own government has been in these global efforts.
Yeah.
Time and time again shown that from a policy perspective, our administration has no interest in working collaboratively with the world.
Yeah.
We want what's best for us right now, not informed by the science, which is like the worst way to approach a global pandemic.
If you look at the big picture, I think I would say like the scientific community has totally stepped up to the plate during this pandemic.
Yeah.
I think corporations have generally also done what would be expected of them. I don't know of any corporate failure during the pandemic. And governments have been all over the place, and including good responses, you know, science-based responsible responses to abject anti-science failure.
Yep.
And the results pretty much track with that. So we're really just basically seeing political failures in this pandemic. That's the problem. Not science failures, not really even industry failures, just political failures, which is, you know, sad. Just sad.
Because yeah, that's so sad. Fixable. I mean,
it's the most fixable thing.
Yeah, you can't make the science go faster than it can go. You can't know things that are not knowable yet because we don't have the right tools or whatever. But you can fix policy failures pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the will.
If you have the will, right. It all comes down to political will. Yeah, right. Which we don't want to get into like how dysfunctional our democracy is at the moment. But this is the price you pay. Right.
On the eve of watching the first debate.
Yeah, it'll be a done deal by the time the show comes out. So. All right, Kara.
Yes.
You're going to give us a what's the word. It's been a while.
Yeah, so I was attending a conference with the neuropsychologist at the hospital where I am now working. And
the hospital? What is it?
The hospital. Yeah. That's going to happen every
white
time.
White building where people...
Dang it. And knitting and knitting. Anymore. We might as well just throw them all out there.
You like Mrs. Spark?
And so an individual who was presenting was using the word decrement. And I realized that I know that word, but it sounded weird in context to me because coming from clinical psychology, it's not a word that's commonly used, but in medical science, it's very commonly used.
In fact, Kara, by not too little of a coincidence, I'm giving a lecture tomorrow which uses the word decrement in
OMG.
The slides.
Yeah, and he used it multiple times because it was like a case presentation. And I was like, ugh, that's jarring because I think I know what that means, but I need to learn more. And I was trying to use context clues. And the more I dug, the more interesting it became. I think that we all know the word decrement, you know, like decremental, right? Mm-hmm. Like we've heard that word. And so when we look at the roots of it, it actually directly translates to the state of decreasing or a gradual loss or waste, which goes back to the Latin, which ultimately goes back to the PIE root, cur, which means to grow. So it's decurring, so it's not growing, or it's actually wasting. But when I was trying to contextually understand what both the individual who was presenting was saying, and then also getting deeper into some of the more specialized definitions, I realized that it's not only used in medical science, which I'm going to give the floor to you in a second, Steve, to maybe help us dive a little deeper into that, but also it's used, interestingly, in physics. It's actually has to do with amplitudes of harmonics. So when things oscillate, the ratio as they kind of move is the decrement, like as they oscillate between each other successively, so they keep going. And in math, it's actually a negative increment would be a decrement, right? It's like the opposite of increment going forward. Right. A decrement goes backward, which is interesting.
Increase, decrease.
Yeah. Right? Increase, decrease. And so that's like actually a similar root, but a different usage of the term.
Mm-hmm.
In medicine, there is a very specific usage which has to do with conduction velocity. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about a decrement, let's say in an individual who has a motor neuron disease, this is actually something that's measurable. There could be a measurable decrement, which is a reduction or a decrease in the conduction velocity.
Actually, it's in the amplitude, not in the conduction velocity.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. Medical Dictionary Online, you need to edit your entry.
In fact, that's the use I'm going to be talking about tomorrow.
It's, good to know.
Yeah. I mean, so with motor neuron disease, you would not get a decrement in conduction velocity because it's not a conduction problem. It's a problem with the number of functioning motor neurons. So you have a decrement in the amplitude, which is a function of the number of motor units that are responding. But I'm going to be talking about a different disease, myasthenia gravis, although it's the same technology. It's a nerve conduction study. This is a repetitive nerve stimulation. And what we see there is, so myasthenia is a fatigable weakness. You get weaker the more you use a muscle. And so we diagnose that partly by doing a 3 hertz repetitive nerve stimulation. So you stimulate a nerve at 3 times per second and you see a decremental response, which means that each time you stimulate it, you get it, the amplitude drops. Right. It kind of picks up a little bit at the end for complex physiological reasons that we'll get into, but it basically, if you have the most of it, you get a decremental response, and you need to see diagnostically a greater than 10% decrement in order to make the diagnosis based on that criteria.
So when you hear the word decrement, like if you're doing rounds or you're speaking with other neurologists, Do you only hear it contextualized as a very specific, measurable reduction? Or do you also hear some people talk about a decrement as just a decrease in function, kind of like a like if somebody's decompensating or they're deteriorating? Do you hear them use it in that context?
Both. Absolutely, okay. Both. So it has very specific technical applications, mm-hmm. and then you use it more generally, you know, to refer to anything that's decreasing.
Yeah. Right. So they have a decrement in motor capability or a decrement in like some sort of, you know, function.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
Just becomes another word in your vocabulary. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a cool word because it's one we don't come across that often, right?
Yeah. Hey, Kara.
Yes, Jay.
It also is the only word that I've ever heard that rhymes with excrement.
Not a perfect rhyme, but it's pretty. It's a rap rhyme for sure.
Yeah,
a rap rhyme.
Like it would work.
Jay, are you having a decrement in your excrement?
I almost broke into rap right now. I had to stop myself. Okay,
you could combine it.
Thank you for that.
You could shorten it and just say that you're having a dexcrement.
A portmanteau, yeah, right?
It's a portmanteau of excrement and decrement. Blah. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Jay, now do promise me you will not do this in rapping rhyme, but tell us about electrical vehicles, right? The adoption of electrical vehicles and climate change. What's the relationship there?
It's a compliment that my excrement is in a decrement.
Oh, no!
All right. So a new study, Steve, has shown us that more electric vehicles on the road won't solve our climate issues. And apparently a lot of people have thought that. I thought that at one point, probably a few years ago, I was thinking, well, you know, if we have a really big increase in electric vehicles, maybe that'll knock things out. But, you know, the pandemic showed us that, you know, a huge decrease in engines that burn, you know, oil-based fuels, right? Gasoline.
A fossil fuel decrement?
Yes. But it didn't do much. So 10 years ago, there were approximately 20,000 electric vehicles globally. Today, there are more than, what would you guys guess?
Would you say 10 years ago it was 20,000?
Yep.
30 million?
I don't think there are that many. Wow. Electric vehicles?
5 million.
1 to 5 million.
Worldwide. Worldwide.
That's
Bob. Still, I don't think it's that popular.
I don't know, man. You tell me.
Evan was close to 7 million.
Okay. Yeah. It's not as many as we'd like. I mean, I'll tell you, when I go to the dealership every time I get a new electric car, there are dealers who don't know anything about it and try to offer me oil changes. Most of the people in the dealership are like, yeah, most of the people in the dealership are like, oh, what weird, an electric car. It's like, and I live in LA.
They're like, why? You're not shocked that it's in there. I did. So someone emailed and said after I talked about batteries, what was that, last week? Mm-hmm. They said that on the long haul, if you get a, you know, not one of the super expensive luxury electric vehicles, but if you get a lower end costing model, that over the long haul, it could be less expensive than a gasoline engine because of all the things, the money that you're going to save from purchasing gasoline.
And lower maintenance.
Yeah, definitely lower maintenance. I haven't seen any – I was doing some research. I haven't found anything to back that up yet. But I do think that we are getting to that point now where very soon it could be absolutely less expensive. So
– yeah, I mean, my car is, I think, the sticker price on it's like 38.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, is that
with a rebate?
No. I think that's the actual sticker price. And that's, you know, I lease it, so I don't pay nearly that much. But I have a pretty standard car. I think I pay like $300 a month for my car lease. It's not a cheap lease, but it's also not an incredibly pricey.
No way. No, that's reasonable. It's reasonable.
Yeah, it's a reasonable lease, and I get to drive a fully electric vehicle that has a 240-mile range. I mean, that's pretty cool.
That is good.
And it's not a Tesla.
Still 38, that's... I don't think 38's a cheap car, not in my
No, book. It's not a cheap car. You're right. But it's not like a luxury. It's not Tesla. It's what Tesla has been working toward. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So engineering researchers at the University of Toronto and the lead author, Alexandre Milovanov, recently had a paper published in a journal called Nature Climate Change. And in it, they explain that once the world does a large-scale move over to electric vehicles, we will still have, like I said, a significant issue with climate change. So electric vehicles are not the silver bullet, unfortunately, that's going to fix climate change. It's just one of many things that we need to do. But here's some details. Electric vehicle adoption is happening all over the world. And as an example, Norway, which is, you know, filled with cool people. I know a guy from Norway who is just an amazing person. But anyway, he knows who he is. They plan to phase out vehicles with combustion engines by 2025. How cool is that? We're talking about 4 years. They're gonna phase out all vehicles with combustion engines, and they're already halfway there. So good for Norway. I mean, they're just doing it, which I think is fantastic. Now, the Netherlands has a similar goal for 2030. Canada and France are clocking in at 2040. And then
California is 2035.
That is fantastic.
That was just signed recently.
Yeah.
So these researchers conducted a detailed analysis of shifting to electric vehicles. So what impact would it have on current emission levels? That is the question. So they selected the United States as the test country because, you know, the average size of our vehicles here are very large. We have a high number of cars per person and also a large amount of travel per person. So they figured, you know, there's a lot of good data coming from the United States, and it's not just a lot of data, but it's high quality data that they can get their hands on. So they figured that would be the right place to test this. So, of course, they use computer models to calculate how many electric vehicles would need to be on the road in order to keep the global average temperature less than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Ugh, that was a mouthful, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How many? They ran this study out to the year 2100, which I was like, whoa, are we really running models out that far? But that's, you know, that's apparently we have to start running models out that far to really see what the effect is going to be. So in order for the United States to meet the required emissions reductions, there would need to be, I have to do it again, how many electric cars would have to exist in the United States in order for us to meet that 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels?
Like percentage-wise?
Yeah, is it a percentage or a raw number?
A raw number.
Well, how many cars are there?
You can give me a number of cars and what you think the percentage would need to be of electric vehicles.
Can I do that even though I read the article?
No.
There are 273.6 million registered motor vehicles in the U.S. Yeah, as
almost one for every person.
Oh, my God.
All right, so, Jay, you're asking how many electrical vehicles we would need in order to do what?
Keep the global warming less than 2C.
Yes.
2C.
Global warming. Global.
2 degrees
just
over pre-industrial levels.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that even possible with any amount?
Half, I assume, like 130, 140 million.
I would think, Jay, that there's no amount that would do that. That it's too late.
Carry the two logarithm.
That's a really good answer, Bob, because you're close to being right. So they're saying that we need to have 350 million electric cars.
So more cars than there are cars.
350?
Yeah, but I think
we're talking about the year 21.
Yeah, they're right, including the increase in population, and they're saying that we would need to be 90% of all vehicles by 2050. In order to be able to do this.
By 2050?
So, and you know, and the first, my first reaction to that figure was, I think it would be that we would be in much better shape than 90% by 2050. I was hoping.
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah, but what did it take? I thought it was a political question.
And don't you need to make assumptions about worldwide car percentages, not just the United States?
Well, we're talking about the United States' contribution to the 2C goal.
You're totally right, Evan. That's part of the problem. So listen, the researchers noted that today there's only 0.3% electric vehicles on the road in the United States, right? 0.3. Yeah, we're not even at 5%. We're at 0.3%. So even with expected electric vehicle price reductions that we talked about, it's only expected to be about 50% electric by the year 2050. And another big consideration, which I think Evan was leaning towards, is that the United States infrastructure would have to dramatically improve. So demand for electricity would skyrocket. We'd have to be about – we'd need about 40% more electrical production than we have today.
For those 90% or for the 50%?
For the 90%.
Yeah. Right. So where's that 40% extra electricity going to come from?
And of course, you know this damn well, Steve. It's not just that. It's also to be able to support the demand, right? The researchers think
–
you know, renewables would not be able to be the sole source of electricity with this level of demand.
Right. It better be nuclear, because that's pretty much it if you're looking in the next couple decades of building up our energy to that
speed. I completely agree, Ev. We're totally there. You know, the the fourth gen reactors are fantastic and people just have to be okay with it.
So that makes the assumption, though, that we're going to be driving a lot more cars in 30 years. 30 years is a long time. What if we're only using 60% of the cars that we use now in 2050? If you've got shared cars, which people are talking about, I mean,
well, they didn't get into the Uber type model, like where you call a car comes, you keep it for as long as you want, then you know it goes away, drives itself away. They didn't get into that. What they did get into was that there's a couple of things that we have to consider here. One is that so there's something called a demand curve, which means that there's requirements for electricity differ depending on the time of day, and the demand curve is very predictable today. But in the future, that demand curve could be nutty. Right? It could be
climate change?
Well, it could be all over the map because you just don't know. It would be very hard to predict what that demand curve is going to be. And it's very hard to predict it means it's very hard to build a system that will service it, right?
So, but with electric cars specifically, you can always charge off peak. That's the great thing about electric cars.
Yeah. So the good news is you can – I think it will become predictable because aggregate behavior can become predictable. But also, yes, you can charge them whenever, including off-peak. So it could be a boon to that demand curve.
Yeah, they all schedule – they have a scheduler in them. Like every electric car has enough technology in it because they're all super high-tech cars that you can just pop in, whether it's in an app or from your dashboard. Don't start charging until this time of night.
But how do you change the oil?
Or be charged by the time I, you know, drive my car at 7 a.m. And it will actually change the intensity, like how much juice is flowing to like extend it or shorten it or whatever.
Yeah. And they might even do things, Kara, in the future where they'll tell you, you know, if you want to be a good citizen, charge your car, you in particular, charge your car at 2 to 3 o'clock today. And they might, like, you know, tell people with software, like, you know, try to distribute the pull on the system. I don't know. I personally just made that up. That's not in their research, but I think.
No, but why couldn't they? I mean, we have time of use meters. Like most in California, you'll get a reduction on your electric bill if you install a time of use meter. And then that'll tell them, oh, I'm pulling most of my electricity from my car in the middle of the night. So I'm going to get a reduction on my energy costs then.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
They said that they don't think renewables in the United States are going to be able to meet the demand. And that's, you know, and I agree with Evan, you know, there is.
It's got to be nuclear.
We have it. It's already there. We just need to invest in it.
We also have to improve the ability for the cars to charge themselves. Like we already have it with passive braking, like resistive braking. But I think that, solar cells, like doing sort of improvements on the cars themselves so that they provide their, you know, or in some ways become a closer thing to a closed system could also be really helpful.
A couple final thoughts here. The researchers were saying, you know, it's going to take work, a lot of work on the infrastructure in every country, but particularly in the United States. And also that we have to start considering things like changing, you know, mass transportation, revamping, you know, transportation in cities because of how the population density in cities is so huge that you could make a big impact by, you know, having trains and buses and everything move over to electric and have it service a lot of people. I love Bob's comment. It to me, it's the holy grail. You don't even own a car. You call a car when you need it. One will show up in minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have underground parking to store these cars, and you know, you're basically paying a rental fee. I think it's a cool model. I'd love to see someone spec it out.
Zipcar. That already exists.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it's just in bigger cities.
Yeah.
They're not electric, but maybe some of them actually are.
But
where you
self-driving.
Just have an app and, self-driving. Self-driving. Gotcha.
Yes.
Yeah, but we're close to that. We're really close.
And keep in mind, we've been talking only about the transportation sector. And I think the biggest lesson from this news item is that we're not going to fix the problem of global warming just by focusing on the transportation sector.
Exactly.
We also have to talk about the energy sector, like how we're producing the energy. And we're going to have to talk about some industries that produce a lot of CO2. We're going to have to do it all. Yeah, absolutely. But it is a good thought experiment about like what can we accomplish just with electric cars and what does that mean and everything. So we have to definitely be looking forward and have a systems approach to this, not think that there's just one change that's going to fix the problem. All right, Bob, what happens when a black hole circles a wormhole?
Oh boy.
And what if you're an asshole?
I used to know the answer to this.
Yes, scientists have recently been speculating on the possibility of using gravitational wave observatories to detect not the usual black hole or neutron star mergers, but the possible merger of a black hole and a wormhole. Now, this was published, I think, in July at the Archive Online. Some big names in this was James B. Dent and William Gabella, they from the Department of Physics, Sam Houston State University, Texas, and the Department of Physics and Astronomy, Vanderbilt University, and their colleagues as well. So, yes, this what is this one all about? This really piqued my interest. But, of course, as usual, I got to throw out some quick background. Gravitational wave astronomy, that's that revolutionary new branch of astronomy that detects not electromagnetic radiation, but the crazy tiny ripples in space-time, far smaller than a proton, caused by titanic events like black hole mergers. Please, Steve, please don't cut all this out. Such an event causes that famous diagnostic chirp graph or sound that you may have heard about. As the black holes or neutron stars spiral closer and closer, the frequency of the gravitational waves increase, and they cause that very specific and recognizable chirp sound or graph, depending how you visualize it. Next is wormholes, and we've all heard about wormholes, right? They're all over science fiction, also called Einstein-Rosen bridges by, I guess, geeks like me. So they're described as shortcuts in space-time that connect distant cosmic locations or perhaps even separate universes. There's obviously never been any observations of wormholes because we'd all basically know about such a discovery.
So these are purely theoretical.
Purely theoretical. But what's less known about wormholes is that their potential existence is grounded in theory, specifically general relativity. There are, in fact, valid solutions to general relativity equations that include wormholes. So that's pretty cool. And you add that to the fact that after many years of trying really hard, no one has been able to show that they can't exist. For what that's worth, they have tried to, you know, to find
disprove,
right, to find mathematically, like, see, mathematically they can't exist because of X and Y, but they can, no one has been able to do that yet, if it's even possible. But you know, just factor that in.
How well accepted are they, though? I mean, is it like on the level of string theory, where it's like, yeah, probably not, but whatever, we'll study it, or is it more like dark matter, where it's like, yeah, probably, but
nowhere
we just haven't
nowhere near
it out
dark
yet.
Matter, closer okay. to
somewhere
strings.
In between.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between. Gotcha.
Hope that helps. So then the question then is, what's the relationship between gravitational waves and wormholes? It might be hard to think, well, what's the connection? Well, some scientists have suggested that gravitational waves can potentially be used to find other things besides smashing black holes and neutron stars. They say they can be used to detect things like cosmic defects, like cosmic strings, some types of exoplanets, and potentially exotic compact objects like wormholes. So wormholes, in fact, as we envision them anyway, actually resemble black holes in important ways. Both objects are characterized by massively curved space-time, right? And they also should both have intense gravitational pull for their size. The difference, though, the critical difference in this context is that once you pass a black hole event horizon, you are not coming back. You could potentially, unless you're, you know, Hawking radiation, you could potentially enter a wormhole, however, and just reverse course and come back. I mean, that is much more plausible than exiting a black hole. So, and that is what these scientists imagined on how we could potentially detect a wormhole using our ground-based gravitational wave observatories, LIGO and Virgo. So in order to explore this idea, Gabella and colleagues considered this. They thought about, all right, say we have a black hole, stellar mass black hole, five times the mass of the sun, 1.6 billion light years away, pretty far away, and it's orbiting a black hole or it's orbiting a wormhole. So they orbit each other, and now picture this. It's orbiting, they're getting closer and closer, and as they get closer, they're going faster and faster. So as they get even closer in their orbits and creating an initially increasing frequency of gravitational waves, like we see the classic chirp, right? As they get closer and closer, frequency increases, and you get this classic chirp. Now, assuming that the wormhole leads to a distant part of the universe, say, or another part, another universe entirely, I guess, that signal would stop. The black hole would enter the wormhole, and that signal would completely stop. The black hole then, of course, would appear in its new location, right? It would just kind of pop out wherever that destination is. But then it would spiral back into the wormhole, where it would reappear back into our universe, spiraling briefly away from the wormhole, right? Creating what's called an anti-chirp. So this is the scenario. So instead of creating just a classic chirp of a black hole or a neutron star merger, what we would observe from our universe would be an increasing and ever-increasing pattern of this. You have a chirp, followed by silence as the black hole disappears, then an anti-chirp as it reappears, spiraling away briefly from the wormhole, and then that's it. That's the pattern. That's the sequence. Chirp, silence, anti-chirp. Then you've got chirp, silence, anti-chirp, and so on and so on. Chirp, silence, anti-chirp, over and over. Each time the black hole would be losing energy to gravitational waves until it completely settles down in the throat of the wormhole at its center. That's how they visualize this merger would happen between a black hole and a wormhole, and how what we would see in the gravitational waves. Physicist Dejan Stokjevic of the University of Buffalo in New York said that you can't reproduce that with two black holes. So it's a clear-cut signal of a wormhole. The waves should be sticking out like a sore thumb. So he's saying that if we detect that pattern that I described over and over of a chirp, silence, anti-chirp, over and over, that would be very, very clear evidence that we potentially have a wormhole here, really more than just potentially, because I can't really think of anything else that could describe that. So that would be an amazing, amazing discovery. Now, of course, this is a fun thought experiment, but just because, as I mentioned, that general relativity has some solutions that support wormholes, and the fact that we haven't been able to disprove them mathematically, of course, right, doesn't mean that they are likely to exist. Those are just things that need to be considered when you're thinking about this. Plus, don't forget, this idea assumes a very specific type of wormhole called the Lorentzian wormhole, which is traversable. Obviously, it's got to be traversable, otherwise this isn't even an idea. But that would need a lot of what's called negative mass. Now, negative mass, you may have heard of this. I think we've mentioned it a couple times. Negative mass, that's not antimatter. It's basically, one way to think of it is an area where the energy of the universe is less than that of an ordinary vacuum. Now, it may turn out to be impossible to get enough negative mass in one place to support a wormhole. Clearly, we have nowhere near the technology to create anything like that. You know, how would that even arise naturally? Not sure, but that negative mass has always been a big stumbling block for wormholes. The cool thing, though, in my mind about all of this, and I think this is very low probability, but I like that this is that we have the technology right now with LIGO and Virgo, our ground-based gravitational wave observatories. We have the technology right now to detect a wormhole like this. It's not like, okay, you know, in 30 or 40 years, maybe we'll have the technology to do this. We have it actually right now. They could potentially discover a wormhole tomorrow or last week. But in end, it's one of those low-risk, massively huge payoff endeavors, you know, comparable, I would say, to discovering intelligent signals in space or proof of like other spatial dimensions. You know, it wouldn't necessarily, you know, impact your day-to-day life, but it would be for people who are, you know, who like this stuff and who are science-minded, this would be gargantuan. And that's because that if we actually had pretty good evidence, even if it was just pretty good evidence for the existence of traversable wormholes, the implications would be amazing. It would not only mean that we could potentially have these connections to vastly separated parts of the universe. I mean, imagine if you could safely enter a wormhole like this and travel a billion light years in the span of, you know, of a mere moment. Of course, you'd have to get to the wormhole, but that's a, you know, so what? I mean, the fact that it even exists, the fact that it's even possible would just be so amazing. And of course, don't even get me started about the potentials for actual time travel into the past using a traversable wormhole. I mean, it's nothing that we could ever even think about doing, because it would take a super high-tech civilization that we can't even imagine to even approach the technology required to utilize it in such a way. But it would mean that it's possible. And if you want to explore that a little bit more deeply, just Google closed time-like curves. And it's fascinating stuff. It's in my mind, it's the only real area of science that even vaguely supports the possibility of travel into the past. So check that out. It's a fascinating topic and cool news item.
Well, can you get back to the present? Or when you're in the past, that's it.
I think if you have a stable wormhole, right, you could be able to go both ways.
Yeah, but one of the downsides from what I've read is that the time traveling... The fact that you traveled in the wormhole wouldn't mean that you would be traveling in time, but the people who would observed you would think that you were traveling into the past. So it's not a cool, it's not the best, you know, Mr. Fusion DeLorean type of time travel, but it is in a sense a type of traveling in the past, and that's probably, you know, the best that science really has to offer at this point, and even that kind of possibility. But it's still fascinating. and highly unlikely. But I mean, we really won't have any, you know, unless we make an observation like this. But even then, we really would need to make solid progress in quantum gravity before we could actually have some really firm, you know, scientific mathematical answers to these types of questions.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Sure.
All right, so guys, I want to talk to you about Neanderthals and Y chromosomes. This is actually a really cool story. You guys remember Denisovans, right?
Yeah.
So this is the simplistic but true enough diagram of recent human evolution is that sometime between 500,000 and 800,000 years ago, the common ancestor of humans, Neanderthals, and Denisovans existed, right? And humans split from another branch, you know, a branch that led to modern humans split from a separate branch that led to both Neanderthals and Denisovans. And then sometime around 600,000 years ago, the Neanderthal / Denisovan branch split into those two, Neanderthals basically in Europe, Denisovans basically in Asia, right? So that's our current understanding based upon multiple lines of evidence, and including DNA analysis of Neanderthals, Denisovans, and human, archaic humans, and modern humans. We also know that humans and Neanderthals did a lot of interbreeding, right? We all, if you're from non-African descent, you have about 2 to 3% Neanderthal DNA. However, there was a new study that was the first to look at the relationship among the Y chromosomes, specifically of Neanderthals, Denisovans, and modern humans. So this would be because that's a good question. So Y chromosomes are unique in that they are inherited strictly from fathers to sons, strictly through the male line, right? All other chromosomal DNA goes from both parents to all children, and mitochondrial DNA goes from mothers to all children, but again, since it only passes through the maternal line. So this is DNA that passes only through the paternal line. So that is really simplifies the analysis of trying to figure out, you know, the relationships and lineages. It also shares a feature with mitochondrial DNA because of this, because of this linear inheritance that it has. It's possible for very few numbers of Y chromosomes to persist to dominate in a population. And if a population gets small enough, you could have just one Y chromosome eking through the bottleneck, right?
Right.
The same is true for mitochondrial DNA. That's like the mitochondrial Eve. You guys remember that? Yeah, we're all descended from this one, you know, female who lived
2 million,
however many, however many years ago.
Multiple times.
It's happened. There have been multiple bottlenecks. There have been multiple bottlenecks. That's absolutely right. Okay. So this is the first time they had DNA from male Denisovans. And so they were able to compare several Y chromosomes from male Denisovans, male Neanderthals, and male modern humans. Now, what would you expect that they would find in terms of which Y chromosomes are more closely related to which other ones, right? You would think, based upon what I told you a few minutes ago, that Denisovans and Neanderthals would be more closely related than either is to modern humans, right?
Okay.
What they found was that Neanderthals and humans were more closely related than either were to Denisovans.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, that was surprising. Yeah. And surprising results in science are always cool. But this is not inconsistent with the inheritance pattern that I previously outlined for you. This doesn't mean that humans are more closely related to Neanderthals than they are to than Neanderthals are to Denisovans. What it could still be that Denisovans and Neanderthals are closely related and less closely related to humans, which branched off earlier. So how could that be? So the study didn't answer that question, but the researchers have an idea of how that could be. And this gets back to what I said about the linear inheritance of the Y chromosome and passing through bottlenecks. Now, the other piece of information that you need to know is that humans and Neanderthals and Denisovans were all getting it on with each other pretty much through our entire history.
Right? Humans wouldn't do that.
So even though we say they quote-unquote split, that just means that the populations were separate enough in space and, you know, geography that they were able to accumulate genetic differences over time. They were different genetic populations, but there was frequent crossover among those populations. So, and we know that, we've talked about this before on the show. There was a recent, you know, fossil, for example, of a 50,000-year-old fossil of a child of a Neanderthal and Denisovan parents, for example. And we have lots of examples of Neanderthals and humans. And as we said, we carry Neanderthal DNA. What they think happened is this, is that a modern human Y chromosome got into the Neanderthal lineage through crossbreeding, and then actually entirely replaced the Neanderthal Y chromosome.
No way.
Wait, what do you mean entirely?
That's cool.
That doesn't sound, yeah, that sounds wrong there.
It doesn't work that way.
No, because
there's a bottleneck.
The Neanderthals passed through a bottleneck, and the human version is the only one that survived the bottleneck. There you go.
And again, bottlenecks are actually really evolutionarily common.
Yeah. Yeah, it just means you have a small, like, you know, 2,000, 3,000, whatever, a small population. So they also say it's quite possible that that was not a random chance that the human Y chromosome is the one that predominated, but that it was selected for. It actually had an evolutionary advantage. The reason for that is because there's something else that bottlenecks do. It causes extreme inbreeding. If you have a very small genetic population, you get a lot of inbreeding, which accumulates, you know, harmful mutations. Too much, you know, kissing cousins, right? So if you had an outbreeding event where a human male had a child with a Neanderthal female and his Y chromosome got into the population, that would have been fresh genetic material that would have been healthier than the inbred Neanderthal Y chromosome and may have predominated because of selective pressures and been far more likely to be the one Y chromosome that squeaked through the bottleneck. And then that's the point at which the clock starts ticking on the differences between human and Neanderthals, not their earlier population split, but that Y chromosome event, that crossover of the human Y chromosome to the Neanderthal population. So it creates the illusion of a closer relationship if you're just looking at the Y chromosome between Neanderthals and modern humans. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Yeah.
But it shows you how complicated this game is, right? Yeah. And in fact, we're looking at chromosomal DNA, Y chromosome specifically, mitochondrial DNA, fossil evidence, and the fossil evidence has multiple independent features that we're looking at. You could look at just teeth, you could look at craniums, whatever. You could look at different aspects of fossil morphology. And you can also look at tools, which is a good representation of culture. And you could basically create an evolutionary tree based upon any one of those lines of evidence in and of themselves. And there actually isn't any reason to expect that they're all going to perfectly overlap each other because of this constant intermixing. In fact, there's evidence of cultural contamination, right? Of, say, a group of Neanderthals learning tools from humans and then, you know what I mean, then acquiring those tools. And so we can't be sure about any individual piece of evidence that, like, you can't say that this tool was only used by this population because maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was picked up by other populations.
Right. If they were biologically capable of mating, they were probably also culturally capable of communicating or in some way getting along.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right. You saw Quest for Fire, right, Kara?
No, I did not.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of interspecies, you know, mating going
nice.
On.
Nice.
A lot of cultural exchanges, you know. Yeah. Totally. So it's a very complicated, fuzzy picture, but it is slowly emerging. We are learning all these little bits. Each piece of the puzzle is falling into place. It's very fascinating. I've been following this since college, so totally fascinated by it. One side point here, when I wrote about this on my blog, one of my commenters asked a very good question that I didn't immediately have the answer to. They said that DNA, you know, basically all humans share 99.9% of DNA, right? So the variation among humans, modern humans, is about 0.1% in DNA. So if non-Africans have 2 to 3% Neanderthal DNA, and Africans have only a tiny amount, mm-hmm. how do you have that 3% difference when there's only a 0.1% difference among any modern humans? And I knew there was something wrong with that logic, but it took me a moment to wrap my head around it and then confirm, you know, by looking it up to, that that was correct. But I did figure it out. And so here's the thing. The 2 to 3% is basically like it's 2% of the 0.1%, right? You're looking at the variance and saying like 2% of this variance can be accounted for by crossbreeding with Neanderthals.
Okay.
So maybe even, and that does extrapolate to the whole genome, but the other way to look at it is that 99.9% of that 3% Neanderthal DNA is the same as our DNA. Does that make sense?
Mm.
I think so.
Yeah. So yeah. It works out. It's not a contradiction. It works out. So all right, here's so I explained it by just looking at ancestry more generally, right? So if I say, for example, that there you do your 23andMe and you find out that you're 90% European and 10% Asian ancestry, does that mean that 10% of your DNA is different from somebody who has 100% European ancestry? No, it's still a 0.1% difference. So the ancestry questions and diversity questions are just totally separate. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I've also done like really deep dives into this topic with Adam Rutherford because it's super confusing.
It is. I know. It's like statistics. Yeah. It's hard. But when I was researching this, I just found a couple of other details that are interesting. So, and we've, I think, mentioned some of this before. So that 0.1% is actually kind of an average figure. It depends on what populations you're looking at. And actually, if you look at just Africans, they have twice the genetic diversity among Africans as there are between Africans and Europeans or Asians.
Yeah.
So it's like it's more like 1.4% and 0.7%, mm-hmm. right? And it averages out to about 0.1%. But
right. And people don't get that. And it's like it's the oldest place on where people ever were. Like, so of course there's more variation there.
Yeah, it supports the out of Africa theory. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is they found that the amount of Neanderthal DNA in Africans is actually more than we thought. We thought it was 0.1%, and recent data said, it's probably more like 0.3%. So still a lot less.
Do they think that's because of migrations back into Africa?
Yeah, probably.
Like people leaving and coming home,
at some
not
point,
necessarily Neanderthals.
At some point,
going
but
to
that's, that could be modern Europeans mixing their genes
totally.
Up with Africans.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally. At any point, you know, but definitely, you know, Neanderthals were European and they mated mostly with modern humans also in Europe, right? But it is pretty cool that we have DNA from Neanderthals and Denisovans, and we are able to make those comparisons. I hope that we get a good sample of the Hobbit, you know, and
Florensis.
Florensis and make DNA analysis there. That would be fascinating because that is yet another branch probably of humans. You know, the diminutive humans from the Isle of Flores.
Island was that? Flores, of course. Yeah. Florensis.
Yeah, Floresiensis. So, yeah, totally cool. And there
may be Floresiensians.
It wasn't that long ago that we discovered Denisovans, and there may be other subpopulations out there waiting to be discovered. You know?
Yeah, Denisovans were not like in my elementary school education.
No.
You know what I mean?
No,
we all knew about
no
Neanderthal.
Way.
That goes back to like caveman, Neanderthal, whatever. But Denisovan was like a newer
Denisovan?
One.
Denisovan?
Yeah,
totally. Contribution.
All right, let's move on. All right, Evan, tell us about how the Navy is promoting belief in the paranormal.
Yeah, you know, it's not just UFOs, right? Sometimes it's ghosts. All right, well, Halloween's right around the corner, right, Bob?
Woo!
As such, it's time for society to ramp up all the ghost stories and scary news items and everything else the media cooks up for mass consumption at this time of year. In the past several years, though, I've noticed a disturbing pattern concerning decommissioned warships, which have basically become museums. They're floating museums unto themselves. People visit, learn about the history of the ship's engagements and their battles and the other important tasks they partook in while they were in service. They're amazing, amazing places. I've actually been on some ship tours and some ship museums. They're wonderful. So there's a great amount of history to be learned by going there. However, in recent years, the museums have allowed themselves to become platforms for paranormal investigation groups. You know, ghost hunters. Haunted ships is a thing. It's a big thing. It's likely an attempt to achieve, you know, advertising, publicity for the museum. You know, they're a business like anything else. Yeah, essentially, that's basically what it is. They you know, these museums are not big money makers. They operate on tight budgets. And, you know, they're going to allow ghost hunter shows on to bring in people, to get people through the gate. Is essentially what happens. And they'll, you know, what happens is these ghost hunters, they'll bring group throngs of people with them onto the ships. They'll all pay their admission or their, you know, heightened admission for the experience. And they'll engage in ghost detection, ghost stories, and all the other trappings of the paranormal industry. So here's the latest example. Just this past Saturday, local news channel 6 in Corpus Christi, Texas, reported that the USS Lexington hosted a paranormal investigation team. It was just this past Saturday. And you know what? They're no shame about it. Directly from the Lexington's website about the tours they offer, one entire category of tour is called paranormal tours, in which a trained paranormal guide leads these tours through spaces around the ship that have reported unexplained sightings or activity. I'm reading right from the website. This experience normally commences in the evening when the ship is closed after 5 p.m. That's when regular visitor activities and noises have settled for the night. Paranormal activity is unpredictable, so there's no guarantee of any encounters with any entities. And they give you the stuff, you know, the details and stuff. $50 per person, per person to get through the door to go on this paranormal tour, which is roughly double of what you would pay to normally go. The nickname of the USS Lexington is the Blue Ghost. And the story goes that in World War II, the Japanese gave it that nickname because it had reportedly been sunk only to reappear several days later. And the ship also sported a dark blue camouflage scheme. And there's some validity to this, although it's not exact, as there was a carrier named USS Lexington, which was sunk at the Battle of the Coral Sea. However, the War Department soon afterwards named a brand new carrier coming right off the line with the same name. So, yes, there were two different carriers with the same name in a relatively short time frame. So that's the story about how it got its nickname, the Blue Ghost. But the fact that it has the nickname Blue Ghost or Ghost in the name makes it more enticing for people to believe in some way that it might be haunted. In fact, the local paranormal society down there, or one of them, they call themselves Blue Ghost Paranormal. And they apparently were founded with the purpose of using the USS Lexington as the centerpiece around all of the activities that they perform. And they go on, the article goes on to interview the fellow who's the chief investigator of this paranormal society, and he says all the usual stuff. You know, when you have nothing happen, it gets embarrassing, but when you do, oh boy, is it exciting. We've had super icy cold spots, we've had shadows, we walking past us in the hallway when nobody's there. He says, I was standing there at one time, I do a pre-walk through, something came up and rubbed my arm, but I didn't see anything. Yeah, so the usual kind of BS that we all know goes along with the ghost hunting stuff. But, and, you know, I would like to say that few, like, this is an outlier, okay? This particular museum is doing it, but unfortunately not. The USS North Carolina Battleship, the USS Salem, the USS Hornet, the USS Yorktown, the USS Batfish, and that's just five. I looked up five in about 10 minutes and found them. So there must be many, many more out there who are doing the same thing, and all pretty much for the same reasons. Look, in some cases, people will pay $500 a night to go on these ghost chases on these ships. It's basically money. Money is king here. And they don't care if it's paranormal. They don't care if they have to, you know, believe in it or not. Just, you know, great to have the money and have fun, you know, chasing your spirits or doing whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have to say, like, from one perspective, like, if that pays for a useful museum or a useful historical location or whatever, I have kind of mixed feelings about it. I don't like it. I think anything that officially promotes that kind of stuff is ultimately harmful. But then you balance that against the fact they're going to say it's just entertainment. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's not like it's alternative medicine or anything. But
yeah.
Otherwise, these museums say, hey, we're going to go under. Either we go under or we have a ghost tour. Take your pick. You know, we've been told that. That's it. You know, and so it makes it, it's like, it's a really hard decision, but it still rubs me the wrong way when they have to, like, sell pseudoscience in order to stay afloat.
I agree.
You hope that they at least like separate it. They keep it really editorially distinct, kind of like this is maybe it's even a second company that runs it, or they don't sell any of the stuff in the gift shop, or, you know, there's a big kind of like line in the sand between what happens during operating hours and what happens almost after when they rent it out to this.
I wish there, and Kara, I thought of the same thing, and I wish there these ships, these museums did have disclaimers to that effect. Mm-hmm. None of them do. And in fact, 3 out of the 5 I researched have direct links, direct pages on their webpage, not going to some third party site or anything, extolling the fact that they do have these kinds of tours. So that's really,
well, it's hard too, because these are like history museums, right? Mm-hmm. They're not like science museums or natural history museums, that's where that would be a much bigger problem.
Now, on the other side of this coin, what it does, Steve, even though, we understand that, you know, they're sort of in a way forced to do it, and it might be understandable on some level, it actually gives these paranormal groups certain levels of credibility that they in no way deserve. And, you know, when you can say that, oh, we're the official paranormal group of the USS Lexington, oh my gosh, it's like you might as well put a military coat on these people, you know, and have them walk around to some degree. Absolutely gives them legitimacy where none, zero, is wanted. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I also think personally, it dilutes the actual history of what's going on there. It sort of sullies people's memories about the people in the Navy, people who actually died on these ships in defense of the country, the war stories. It all gets watered down. Here are some of the real stories. Here's just I listed just 8 quick things about the USS Lexington. The oldest Essex-class carrier still in existence. Longest active service life of any Essex-class ship. Awarded 11 battle stars in World War II, and that's the number of encounters where the ship came under fire by enemy forces. It also received something called the Presidential Unit Citation, which at the time was the highest honor a vessel could carry. It fought in the Battle of the Philippine Sea, the Battle of Leyte Gulf. I mean, these are like, you know, enormously popular, well-known battles in World War II history. The first women to have served aboard aircraft carriers, USS Lexington. And it is also a National Historic Landmark. And that's just a couple quick things I looked up on it.
Yeah, so here's a couple of things. So one is that, we can complain about this, but I do think this is a good reason to, you know, spend your money in these museums, historical museums, et cetera, and these historical locations to support them. Do it, you know, out of the, not within the context of the ghost tour, but do it like just looking at the history.
Museum gift shops have cool stuff, guys.
Yeah, great stuff.
I love museum gift shops. I always find the coolest stuff there.
I should.
I'll have you an hour in that story.
This is a great opportunity for people with wealth, like with money. You can endow a museum on the condition that you never have a ghost tour. You know, and I'm sure they would love it because they hate, I mean, at least, you know, the ones that we've spoken to, they hate it. It's like the devil's bargain they have to make. But but again, it's like, at some point, it's like, what's the point? This historical location is now 100% ghost tours and gift shop selling crap. And the actual mission of education has vanished in the middle.
Yeah.
So it does, you know, in the long run, it just becomes counterproductive.
I agree. Agree totally.
Well, what are you going to do?
Yeah. What can
it's
you
the
do?
The world we live in.
Yeah.
We'll keep fighting the fight. We'll keep fighting the fight. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, it has that pattern of two things slowly getting out of sync, you know.
Dot matrix printer is what it sounds like to me.
Sure.
There's a little bit of that in there, but there's it doesn't sound exactly like a dot matrix. But it could be some kind of machine, you know, that is
yes. Yes, you're onto it, Steve.
A
listener named Stuart Harrington wrote in and said, Jay, it's rare for me to even be able to get a timely guess in, so I'm going to get super specific with this guess with the hopes of a glorious solo victory. This is not just a CNC machine. It is not just a CNC machine cutting wood. This is a CNC machine cutting wood into a ball with someone's name on it, like in Minority Report. The name on the ball is Jay Novella.
Who are you about to do in, Jay?
But Jay, don't worry. You're not premeditating murder. There's a Minority Report implicating me because I just killed Who's That Noisy?
I see what you did there.
Okay, so this was good. It's not a CNC machine. Thanks for sending that in. Evil Eye sent in the next one. Hey, guys and lady, my guest for this week is a paper shredder, and the end is it finishing? Huh. And then he says, do you think Kara knows what a slee stack is?
No.
Oh,
what?
Slee stack?
Weren't you born in 1975?
I wouldn't expect it.
I was born in 83.
Yeah, you missed it. It was a 1970s live-action Saturday morning show.
With some stop-motion photography.
Yeah, Marshall, yeah. Will, and Holly.
Yeah.
Yeah, just leave it to me. I will send her a link, and next week she'll know what a slee stack is. Yeah.
Okay.
She doesn't know who Chaka is. That's even crazy. Yeah. Okay.
I know. All right, so Chaka Khan is. Chaka is.
So here's one more. This was sent in by a listener named iPuppy. Hey, Jay, at first I thought this was an ATM, the mechanism that counts the money and then pushes it out of the slot, but there was enough delay between the counting and the noise and the slot opening noise, and also that it would have been a lot of bills. I'll say it is specifically a machine to draw and coil wire.
Ooh. What? Okay.
So this is not a bad guess. I've heard machines do that, and there is a repetitive thing happening there. This is, however, not correct. We have a winner from last week. It's Micah Woodward, and Micah said, hi, Jay. I definitely remember hearing that exact noise before, but it took me a while to remember where it was from. It's the lock-picking lawyer showing off his robotic safecracker.
Cool.
So this is a mechanism. This is a dial safe, right? It's a hand dial safe. You put this mechanism on top of it, and it grabs onto the dial, and then it can spin. And, of course, there's a computer attached to the spinning mechanism, and it goes through a series of, you know, I don't think it's listening. I think it's just doing a, what would you call this type of thing when you try every possibility? There's a specific hack called that. Mm-hmm.
Brute force.
It's a brute force. Yeah, it's a brute force type of attack. ITL 2000 safecracker machine. A lot of professionals use it.
Wow.
And the thing connects to the dial. It could take 8 to 30 hours for it to run through the various combinations and get to the point where it opens the safe. So 8 to 30 hours for this machine to crack open one of those safes. But it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. You can buy it. You hook it up.
So, Jay, why is it 8 to 30 hours? Shouldn't it be 1 second to 30 hours? What if it gets lucky right out of the gate?
I guess on average. It has to. I don't know.
It's got
to
be a probability.
What if you actually coded your safe with 0000?
There's got to be a probability attached to that. Like there's a 99% chance that it will be done in 8 hours or whatever.
But
you're so pedantic.
The reason why this noisy was the length that it was the guy running the experiment put in the first two numbers. That's how long it took for it to run through to whatever it goes up to.
Yeah.
So
yeah, makes sense.
It's a long process. So they hook it up. The guy goes home. He calls. Did it stop? No. Okay, I'll call you tomorrow. Takes a while to do it. Anyway,
so when
that's
you say
cool.
professionals, then you mean like police
locksmiths.
Officers?
Not professional safe. Crackers,
not thieves.
Not criminals. Yeah, okay. These are people that do it legally and
ethical safe crackers. If there's such a thing.
they're called white hat safe crackers.
Yeah, empowered safe cracker. Yep. Yeah.
All right, I have a new noisy this week. This was sent in by a listener named Cody Grills. Check this out. I partly picked this noisy because this will be the noise that I make tonight as we listen to the debates.
Yeah, it's one of those noises that could sound like an animal or a machine. You know what I mean?
But either way, it doesn't sound happy.
I like the vagary of that. I do. I appreciate that you said that, Steve, because that's one of the things I listen for. You know, it's like, how will people react when they hear this? I'm always thinking about what the audience will think. And first off, I want someone to possibly be able to win. You know, there are people that send me noisies. I'm like, yeah, that's really cool. But like, forget it. You know, there's just no way anyone's going to be able to guess that. But I'm not saying this to dissuade you or to decrement the number of people who send me in emails. But I will ask you, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org if you heard a cool sound this week or if you'd like to guess. So, Steve, I want to just to remind everybody that the SGU has broken 4,000 patrons. And this was largely due to us asking our patrons for their help because we absolutely need financial support right now because of how bad the lack of advertising is on the show. You'll notice that if you are listening to the show that has ads, it doesn't have ads. It has one ad every once and again. So anyway, thanks again for your help. And we always, always appreciate the support that you give. But we broke 4,000, and this means a few things. One, we are going to do a 12-hour show. We decided that we're going to do this sooner than later.
Yeah.
We're going to live stream it from the studio at some point in January, mid to late January. And then the Star Trek Museum thing, I'm still working on it. It's still going to take time to hammer it out. But that can't happen until COVID is done anyway. So let's just put that on the – it's in front of us, but it's on the whenever burger.
It'll be a good way to celebrate the end of the pandemic.
Yeah, agree.
Exactly.
Yeah, huh?
So we will be doing the 12-hour live stream. We have already, I've already basically done my, list of initial ideas, and we're going to really all start working on this very hard.
That sounds like somebody taking a really long piss.
What, that noise that I played?
No, the 12-hour live stream.
Oh, man.
Well, it's going to be a lot better than that. So we are giving away a Star Trek Universe-styled phaser rifle that was made by David Tremont, who works at Weta Studios. He built us basically, he built four of these, one for me, Bob, and Steve, and one for a listener. And it was
five.
It was
he also built one for the head of Weta.
Yeah, that came after. Yeah. But oh, yeah, cool. He did end up building five of them. Because
he saw it and said, that is cool. I want one.
I did say last week that you could still enter. You can't enter anymore. We have formally closed it down. You're no longer able to enter into this contest. A winner will be selected. I have to do the math now and figure out all the numbers because there are different, different people will get different amounts of entries. Actually, the only way you could still enter is if you become a patron before I do the scrape of all the patrons mm-hmm. and figure out everybody's points that they get. We're gonna pick soon. It's gonna happen very soon. I'm really excited because it could be anybody. You just don't know where this person is gonna be or who they are. I just hope if the people who entered will truly be able to appreciate this thing because it's amazing. The guy David makes hero props for movies and it's on that level. It's just really, really a beautiful thing. So we will keep you informed. We're talking about it, and we're all very excited.
All right, we're going to do one quick email. We've got a few of these, but this one comes from Rich from Dayton, Ohio. Rich says, I'm sure you've gotten many emails on this one. We have. Any chance you can or can get a mathematician to explain how things like reality compensating for changes that time traveler make can be expressed mathematically? Feels like trying to have an equation for free will or maybe just a smile. So Rich is referring to a study. And this is a study asking the question, can you have time travel without paradox? You sure. Guys are all familiar with the time travel paradox, right? Where mm-hmm. what happens if I go back in time and kill my own father, before he has me, and then I won't then therefore be around to go back in time to kill my father. So then sure. I'll exist, et cetera. So there's a paradox there, right? And this is like a favorite nerd pastime to talk about time travel paradoxes and their existence in fiction. And of course, Back to the Future always comes up because that's like a total CF of time paradoxes. But this is a physicist trying to take like a serious, asking seriously, could you have a system in which time travel occurs, but paradoxes never occur. Not just that they don't always occur, that they would never occur.
So what was their solution? Is it like an observation, like you're in an alternate universe or something?
No.
Well, that's one classic solution, Steve, right? The branching parallel universes. It's not satisfying, but that would solve it because anything could happen because it's a different branch of universe. So
But he's talking specifically about a closed time-like curve. So specifically going
What's
back
that?
In time in your own universe. Yeah, so that space-time will bend in reaction to gravity, right? As they say, mass tells space-time how to curve, and space-time tells mass how to move.
Move, right. Yeah,
yeah, so if it's possible, at least within the confines of general relativity, that you could have a space-time curve that loops back on itself and therefore goes back in time. And this, by definition, is back in time in your universe. That's yeah. Right.
Well,
so,
I mean,
so you can't. So you don't have the other. You don't have the other universe out.
Okay.
With this thought experiment, we'll just say that.
Well, people have talked about it. There is. I'll give you an example. Say, there's a name. There's a name for this. One. It's called the Novikov self-consistency principle.
What?
And that means that events causing a paradox basically have zero probability. So,
yeah.
But that's the extent of how my definition of that. I'm not sure how fleshed out that is. But basically, events conspire somehow to prevent a paradox from happening. And we've seen that in movies as well.
Yeah.
What's the force that's forcing those situations to happen? It's kind of, you know, ambiguous, nebulous. It's not really defined.
What's the force that keeps particle from occupying, you know, a definitive
exclusion
space and time
principle?
Yeah, but that's just a principle. What's the force behind it? It's like it's in that realm of,
yeah,
you know, wibbly wobbly tiny.
This is kind of macro scale, though. This is kind of macro scale. It's different.
All right, but here's the dilemma inside a dilemma, or the paradox inside a paradox, is that if you have that, you mentioned that principle. What was it called again?
The Novikov self-consistency.
The Novikov self-consistency principle kind of implies that there's no free will. Because you are not free to choose that you kill your parents, right? You, like, the universe would conspire to keep you from being able to make a free choice in that decision. Mm-hmm. Now, there are people who are perfectly happy with that solution. They say we don't have free will because you know, we are just following the natural laws of the universe, right? And those natural laws include the Novikov principle, where you can't create a paradox. So, yeah, you cannot consciously create a paradox because you don't have free will anyway. Mm-hmm. But some people don't like that, because even in a universe without free will, it should still feel like you have free will, right? You should
because it does right now.
Because it does right now. Like, and this is a little bit too much to say that, no, you just can't do that because the universe doesn't want you to do it. The quote-unquote solution, or the thought experiment that, you know, the paper comes up with, is that there could be multiple solutions, that there could be multiple closed time-like curves, and you can choose among any of them, just none of them that cause a paradox, right? So there could be multiple, maybe infinite, non-paradox closed time-like curves. So all of your choices are confined to those. So you still have free choice. You can still make decisions. You can still do different things, but they always result in a non-paradox. But you could, and in fact, if you go back in time, you could do things differently the second time and take a different path, right? A different closed time-like path. But this time, it still avoids the paradox, right?
Wait, somebody wrote a whole paper about this?
Yeah. Yeah.
God,
this seems like a tautology.
Sort of, yeah.
Doesn't it? Like, no, it's not going to affect change because it doesn't affect change. And there are lots of options that don't affect change. So that's why I got out of the argument.
He's just pointing out that if there's multiple non-paradox closed time-like curves, you can still have the illusion of free will. I think that's his only point.
But that's...
You still have the illusion of free will.
Required a whole paper?
Yeah. You know, like I said, the nerds love this shit. Yeah.
It still doesn't satisfy my wondering of how. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, maybe what are the parameters of options that have no outcome? Like, no downstream effect? Because don't we think that everything downstream, isn't that the whole point of the paradox?
Not that it has no downstream effect. It says it doesn't create a paradox.
An impossible situation.
Yeah, an impossible situation.
Just an impossible situation.
Right.
Yeah. But you, like, could still massively change the future.
You can't. You can't kill your own parents, right?
Gotcha. That's the only thing. Oh, okay, that helps.
Yeah, that's the classic example.
Helps. Okay.
Right. And but we should point out that while general relativity allows for the possibility of time travel, that particle physics and quantum mechanics probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so this may all
so
be
this
for
is a
naught
moot
anyway.
Point anyway.
Yeah, and that kind of leads to Hawking's chronology protection conjecture, basically saying that
chronology protection conjecture.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing. I mean, the idea is that the law of physics prevents time travel on all but microscopic scale. So this would never, so paradoxes can't really happen at the macro scale, because physics conspires to prevent you from traveling into the past. Like, say you discover a wormhole, but wormholes exist, but they're only microscopic, and you'd have to prop it up with negative mass, but that's impossible to get enough of it to prop it up. So it's just, you can't do it. You're close, but you'll never be able to do it. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So no TARDIS, what you're saying.
No.
Not looking good.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a theme this week and four items just because it's special. So the theme is predicting the future.
Of course.
Now, these are four predictions that people made in the past about their future, which is our present, or close enough.
Okay.
And, yeah, so three of these are actually predictions that people made, and one of them is not.
Okay,
so basically everything is true. It's whether or not the prediction happened.
No. Wow. Oh.
No. So right. Actually, in actuality, all of these predictions are false.
Right.
Oh,
but
okay.
Three of them were actually made by the people that I said made them. And one of them is not a prediction that person made, right?
Got it.
Yep.
So when I was doing this at first, it was like, you know, you come across a bunch of predictions about what's not going to happen. And basically every single major technological breakthrough has somebody who said this will never work. It will never happen. People will never do this. Every single one. So that's boring, right? No matter what you say, the telephone, nobody's going to ever buy that. Whatever. You know, there was somebody who predicted it would fail. That these cars are never going to replace horses, you know, whatever. So I abandoned that approach. So these are predictions about things that didn't happen, right?
Okay.
So you'll understand. Here we go.
Yep.
Item number one, John Elfreth Watkins Jr., the curator of mechanical technology at the Smithsonian Institution in 1900, predicted by that the 2000s, there will be no C, X, or Q in our everyday alphabet. They will be abandoned because unnecessary. That's an exact quote. They will be abandoned because unnecessary.
Because that's how language works.
Yeah, item number two. In 1911, Thomas Edison predicted it will be an easy matter to convert a truckload of iron bars into virgin gold. Item number three, here's the quote, nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners will probably be a reality in 10 years. That was said by Alex Lewitt, president of the Lewitt Vacuum Company, 1955. So nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners by 1965, I guess. And then item number four, Nikola Tesla predicted in 1935 that, quote, by the dawn of the 21st century, alcohol will no longer be consumed by mankind, who will have evolved beyond the need for such tonics. Bob, I don't think you've gone first in a while.
You bastard. All right, these are good, Steve. So let's go with Watkins. No C, X, or Q in our everyday alphabet. Dude, come on. That's just ridiculous. Because like I said, that's how language works, right? So yeah, I'll say that one's probably, I don't know, whatever, what I'm trying to say with that one. But let's see. So the second one here, iron bars into gold, virgin gold. Edison said that? He's believed in that nonsense? Wow, that would be a surprise. So I'm not sure about that one. That one doesn't look like it's very scientific. The nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners for number three. Yeah, they were saying everything was going to be nuclear-powered. Although I can't remember an example that was so small scale. You know, not like cars or planes, but a vacuum cleaner. The time frame sounds right, 1955. But that, I mean, oof. Let's see. So now we got Tesla saying that no alcohol. I mean, he was, you know, visionary, but also kind of kooky. But was he that kooky? Beyond the need for alcohol. Now, if he said we would have something far more effective than alcohol, that would be a different prediction.
Synthol.
But did Edison? I've never heard anything about Edison that would make me think he would think that we can convert base metals like that into gold. easy matter to convert, but it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't really surprise me. All right, screw it. Then, all right, I'll say that the nuclear-powered vacuum cleaner is false.
Okay. Kara?
I feel like I might have to go with what Bob was leaning toward. Like, I definitely think the C, X, and Q thing is bananas, but I buy it because those letters are redundant. Other letters make the same sound. I think that nuclear-powered vacuum cleaner seemed like, yeah, somebody would have believed that that would happen, so long as it had a good case on it. I think the Tesla one sounds right because it's right after Prohibition. So obviously that was like on people's minds in the 30s. But the one that really rubs me the wrong way is Edison being an alchemist.
Yeah.
It's just like, really? Like 1911? I could see it if you were talking about like Newton or something, but Edison? I don't know. So I don't think Edison was an alchemist. So I have to say that's the fiction for me.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, so the first one about the alphabet, I mean, I don't even know who this guy is, but I could see somebody saying that.
It's the curator of mechanical technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not familiar. I don't know. I really don't know, like, why he would make that prediction if he was, like, studying this type of thing. Who knows? Thomas Edison, I don't think highly of him. And I just kind of think of him as a really mean boss. And I could see him saying something stupid like this. Especially like into virgin gold, like, yeah, virgin gold. Something about the vacuum cleaners is tickling something in the back of my head. And I honestly don't think that anybody that lived back when Tesla did would say anything negative about alcohol. I think alcohol was widely loved and used because of how hard life was. So I think that one's a fiction.
Okay, Evan, so it's got 1 for 2, 1 for 3, 1 for 4.
Yeah, okay. Well, real quick, Watkins Jr., no C, X, or Q in our everyday alphabet. I do think that one is science. C, in the German language, there are 25 letters. There's not a 26th letter. And C is a very seldom used sort of letter, at least words beginning with C. So, and as Kara pointed out, they make, you know, these letters make other sounds. So I think that one's right. With Edison, I'm leaning towards that one being the fiction. Would he have used the word truckload in 1911? When was the truck invented? Was it even invented? Right? Truckload is such a modern kind of phrase. I'm not sure it would have been used back then. And also, yeah, alchemy, I never heard of that. He's not, you know, I never heard of him being an alchemist. Heard a lot of stories about him. With the other stuff, I just don't know about the vacuum cleaner. That could very well be Nikola Tesla. I think he was a teetotaler, wasn't he? If memory serves, so I'm not surprised.
What's
that he kind of a
teetotaler.
So I'm not surprised he may have had someone who doesn't drink alcohol.
Oh, like me.
Yeah, and Steve. So I'm thinking that perhaps his anti-alcohol stance may have played into that. Therefore, it happened. And therefore, I'm with Kara on this one. Edison, fiction.
And Jay, sorry to interrupt, but like, you've never heard of anybody in 1935 saying they were against alcohol?
I know, but what I mean is, even during Prohibition, you know, most people wanted alcohol. You know, it wasn't like this.
No, some people wanted alcohol, but a lot of people pushed really hard to make it illegal. Mostly women. Anyway, yeah. Okay.
Let's go. So you all agree on the first one, opening the door for a sweep. So we'll see what goes on here.
Oh, boy.
John Elfreth. Elfreth.
Oh, shit. Did you make this guy up?
Junior, the curator of mechanical technology. The curator of mechanical technology. At the Smithsonian Institution in 1900, predicted that by the 2000s, there will be no C, X, or Q in our everyday alphabet. They will be abandoned because unnecessary. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's got to be a bit of a nut job. So this was in the Ladies' Home Journal. He wrote an article on the future of language. He also said that we will be communicating with condensed words expressing condensed ideas. So
we
in text. In 2020, that's true. He actually anticipated text. But he said, so in 2020, we may say to our friends, me happy, good hi.
We do. We use emojis too.
We don't speak that way, but if you apply that to texting, you're absolutely right. You know, WTF, man. All right.
Some of us talk that way too. I say WTF out loud because I've been saying
L number 8 R.
LOL.
but we still have a C, X, and a Q. But he is correct. Yeah. They are redundant. Okay. Let's take them in order. 9/11. In 1911, Thomas Edison predicted, quote, it will be an easy matter to convert a truckload of iron bars into virgin gold. Kara and Evan, you both think this one is the fiction. I believe you two won last week and Bob and Jay lost.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, pressure. This one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was an alchemist?
Ouch. Flip it. Well, you know, nuclear, GTK, and all that stuff.
Oh, no. Maybe the word truck was used for something else, yeah, Evan, no, yeah. Like the back of a...
Truck,
I don't know, yeah. Trolley or something.
Or trains and stuff, yeah, or just a horse would pull a truckload.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to number three. Nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners will probably be a reality in 10 years, says Alex Lewitt, president of the Lewitt Vacuum Company in 1955. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is... Science, yes.
Oh, wow.
Nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners.
Wow. I heard that before. We've heard that before.
Have we?
Maybe.
At that scale, vacuum cleaner? I was surprised.
So all of this means that Nikola Tesla predicted in 1935 that by the dawn of the 21st century, alcohol will no longer be consumed by mankind, who will have evolved beyond the need for such tonics, is fiction. But
good job.
But Tesla was a kook who predicted something similar.
What did he say?
What he predicted was that by the end of the century, we would no longer consume tea, coffee, or tobacco.
Huh.
Oh, my God.
He said,
no longer tea,
that
something that's been around since like the beginning of humankind.
Tea, coffee, tobacco, because we would no longer have the need to poison ourselves with these.
With tea?
Yes. However, he then said, but we'll definitely be still drinking alcohol because that is the nectar of the gods. So he was down
himself. You were all over that
with alcohol.
Hilarious.
So that's why I was confident that was a fiction, because he said the exact opposite.
That's so weird.
Isn't that weird? Apparently. He also thought that women would take over the world, like in a bad way.
In a bad way.
like men taking over the world isn't in a bad way.
Yeah.
Wait, Tesla was sexist? That's
totally. And also, he kind of thought that he said that eugenics is going to be, you know, the law.
Oh, that, gosh. Like,
right. That was very of the era.
Yeah, 30s. Oh, boy. German thinking and stuff. Yeah.
Well, and at the time when eugenics first was getting, because it was popular in America before it was popular in Germany.
Yeah.
And when it first was getting its legs, it was actually viewed as like a social good. It wasn't necessarily a racist thing. It was a let's make children who aren't sick.
Yeah.
Like it was very viewed in that way.
Innocent intentions.
Yeah, it was all about like, let's make it so that there's no more deficits and so that people are healthier and happier. And then it got twisted.
Yes,
into,
of course.
Yeah.
He thought that we would evolve into a bee civilization where men were drones and the queen bees ruled everything.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Man. Clearly needs to drink more coffee.
Yeah, clearly. He thought we would have fuel-less passenger flying machines.
Fuel-less. Hmm. Someday.
Yeah.
Jay, so you got this one.
Jay, totally.
Yeah, good job, Jay.
Jay, and I'm sitting here saying, how could you possibly think that people would be not anti-alcohol in the 30s?
Yeah, but you're right. It was prohibition, but I just thought that most people still wanted to drink. There was just a minority of people who were fighting
against it. You're right. It was definitely a minority, and they were like hardcore kind of religious women and people who were like sick of their husbands beating the shit out of them. And like,
because the mob, Kara, mob was making a ton of money smuggling booze. You know,
here's a good one. This is a particularly timely prediction. Quote, long before the next century dawns, systematic reforestation and the scientific management of natural resources will have made an end of all devastating droughts, forest fires, and floods.
Wow.
There you go. Right on the money. Now, Jay, you were harshing on Thomas Edison, but Edison was really prophetic in most of his technology predictions, not the gold one, but... All right. Good job, Jay.
Thank you. Woo-hoo.
Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote is brought to us by listener Eric Droget from Australia. Hope I pronounced that right, Eric. If I didn't, I apologize.
Is it Droget?
Could be. There's two T's. There's usually not silent on two T's.
I don't know. I have no idea.
But in any case, thank you, Eric, for this quote. There are, in fact, two things, science and opinion. The former begets knowledge, the latter, ignorance. Hippocrates.
Hippocrates.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Hippocrates. Yeah. That's right. Bill and Ted.
So hypocritical.
Reaching back into antiquity for this week's quote. I liked it.
Science and opinion. Very good. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Thank
you,
Tesla.
We'll see you on the Friday live stream. And then until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.